you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
And tan and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes, ah. When she walks, she's like a samba that swings so cool and sways so gently, that when she passes, each one she passes goes, ah.
In 1964, Brazilian singer and guitarist João Gilberto and his wife Astrud traveled from Rio de Janeiro to New York City for a recording session that would become famous. João was collaborating with saxophonist Stan Getz on a jazz album notable for its Brazilian influences and composers like Antonio Carlos Jobim. Astrud, who'd never recorded professionally before, was asked by her husband in studio on the spot to sing some English lyrics to one of the Jobim compositions. Everyone loved what they heard, including album producer Creed Taylor. And the rest is history. More than a million copies sold, Grammy Song of the Year, nomination for Best Vocal Performance, and the launch of Brazilian Bossa Nova into the American pop culture stratosphere. Astrud Gilberto would go on to a four-decade singing career here in the U.S., and she died yesterday at the age of 83. An understated performance, perfection from the young Astrud Gilberto. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. A very good Tuesday morning to you. I'm Larry Mantle. Thank you again for your support for Air Talk yesterday, making that challenge right at, I was going to say the 11th hour, it's really at the noon hour, and you brought it home. Thank you so much for your support. A wonderful that we're off to a strong start with reaching our challenge in Morning Edition just minutes ago. And again, we ask you for your support throughout the course of just these next few days. But we begin with important news in Sacramento, where the legislature is taking up a number of proposed constitutional amendments here in California. Now, for this type of a constitutional amendment, it requires two-thirds support from members of the state legislature, which is a tough thing to do if that's proposed by a Republican, given Democrats' supermajority. Then it has to go to California voters for their approval. There are a number of them that are up for consideration in the legislature, and joining us to talk about them from CAP Radio in Sacramento, reporter covering politics and government, Nicole Nixon. Nicole, so good to have you with us this morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start. First of all, one of them is ACA 5, which would repeal Proposition 8, which was passed by California voters, but was overturned by federal courts as unconstitutional. This would remove language defining marriage as between a man and a woman, and would also provide some other marital protections. Nicole, share with us a bit about why legislators are proposing doing this.
Yeah, well, it's really because of last year's ruling on abortion. You know, after that, advocates worry that next on the chopping block, you know, is rights for same-sex marriage and interracial marriage, that the cases that set precedent for those rights could be on the chopping block next. And like you said, this would repeal the Proposition 8 language, which was approved 15 years ago, but that's still on the books. So the lawmakers proposing this, members of the LGBTQ caucus say that they want to replace that Prop 8 language with a constitutional guarantee for the fundamental right for adults to marry in California.
Also being taken up in the legislature, ACA 8, which would ban involuntary servitude as a form of criminal punishment. It's similar to an amendment that failed last year. A number of states have passed their own constitutional amendments which outlaw this, which would restrict for the most part labor that would be performed by incarcerated Californians. And is this very different in substance from the amendment that was voted down last year?
I don't think so. So this would either, it's unclear to me though, whether this would stop or restrict prison labor or require that people doing that labor maybe are given the choice and then are paid fairly for it. I think it is interesting to note that a bunch of red states have done this in recent years. Nebraska, Alabama, Utah, Tennessee, and Oregon have passed this in the past, 3 or 4 years. And it's also worth noting that, yeah, this did come up in the legislature a couple of years ago, did not make it through. And also California relies heavily on prison labor. We've heard about fire crews that are staffed by inmates that got a lot of backlash because they're paid pennies. And then when they get out of prison, they have a hard time getting work in that industry because of their criminal records. Another interesting layer to this is just I was having a conversation with a colleague yesterday, and she was looking into a bill that would allow, the eyeglasses that Medi-Cal recipients get are actually made by prison labor in California. So there's a proposal to let Medi-Cal recipients get eyeglass prescriptions from a private company, but moving that to a private company would cost the state millions of dollars because it wouldn't be getting those eyeglasses for free anymore, right?
Yeah, we're talking with Nicole Nixon, reporter covering politics and government for CAP Radio, our fellow NPR member station. This may be the most controversial of them, ACA 10, which would recognize in the California Constitution what is called adequate housing as a constitutional right. Now, that is scheduled to be debated tomorrow in the Assembly Housing Committee. There are states, and I think the city of New York, for example, has embedded in its laws that there is a right to shelter. But that there's a distinction between shelter and housing. Mm-hmm. What California is considering, and it isn't just housing, it's adequate, which, of course, would be subject to definition at some point. So, Nicole, share with us, how heavy a lift is this for the legislature to get this on the ballot?
Yeah, I think this will be really controversial and the debate tomorrow should be really interesting. Supporters of this constitutional amendment insist that it would not require the government to provide housing for everybody. Supporters say that it would, its intent is to pressure local governments to do more to provide housing. I think it's interesting, the language chosen here to go with housing, whereas, like you mentioned, in New York, there's a right to shelter. There's been also, even getting adequate shelter for people living on the streets has been quite the challenge here in California. So I'll be really interested to see how this one does.
Yeah. And I'd be interested, too, about the prospects with voters, because I could see where a right to shelter might have a better chance with voters than a full on right to adequate housing, which might be give some voters more pause. It'd be really interesting to see how this plays in committee and later on. SCA 1 would revise laws on recalling state officials and the governor. It's being heard in the Senate Appropriations Committee. Is this just to make the threshold much more challenging for this?
Yeah, I mean, we heard a lot about the recall laws after the failed Gavin Newsom recall in 2021. Many of his allies said that it's too easy to get a recall on the ballot. And, there was a lot of talk about the setup of these elections is really confusing to voters with the two questions. Can you vote to recall? And then do you have to choose a replacement? So this proposal would amend the Constitution so that a recall of a statewide official is just that one question. Should they be removed from office, yes or no? Okay. And then in the case of a governor, if they are removed from office before 2 years into their term, that midpoint, then there would be a special election afterward to choose that replacement candidate. This is interesting because it could also affect the candidates that run. With Gavin Newsom on the ballot, a lot of Democrats are really hesitant to jump in because it could look like they're going against him. But then if the other thing this constitutional amendment would do is that if this official is recalled past that midpoint, then the lieutenant governor would be elevated to governor and serve out the remainder of that term until the next election.
Probably every bit as controversial as the considered right to adequate housing is ACA 4. It would allow incarcerated Californians to vote. It's past committee and is up for a vote before the full assembly. We only have about 30 seconds left, Nicole, but what's your sense of this one and its likelihood to go before voters?
Yeah, I'm really interested to see whether it does or not. I mean, this is one of those things. Most states don't allow people with felony convictions or anyone in prison to vote. So, this relationship between California and prisons, very interesting to watch and how it'll go in the full assembly, maybe later this year.
Nicole, thank you so much. Really appreciate you walking us through the array of proposed constitutional amendments the legislature's taking up. We appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
Thanks from Cap Radio in Sacramento. She covers politics and government. Nicole Nixon.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Thank you so much for your support. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up later on the program, we'll be talking with Los Angeles City Council member Eunice Hernandez, who has proposed a study that Los Angeles is poised to undertake on whether apartments should be required to have air conditioning. This all part of warming temperatures here in Los Angeles. Of course, there'd be substantial cost in doing that, with many particularly older buildings don't have the ductwork to do that. We're going to talk with her and hear what she has to say about that proposal and how that might work financially. But right now we turn our attention to cars, because as we were just talking about some of the economic stressors that people are experiencing, one of the big ones is trying to buy a car right now, because there are still some inventory shortages with new vehicles, and used cars during the pandemic saw extraordinary increases in price. As a result, Americans are keeping their cars longer than ever. The average American vehicle on the road right now is 12 and a half years old. That is the record. 12 and a half years. That's the average. That means there are a lot of cars out there that are 16, 18 years old, 20 years old. For sedans, it's even higher. The average age of a sedan on the American road today is over 13 and a half years. And average monthly car loan payments now top $700 a month, which for a typical American family, you know, trying to take on all the other costs they have, very, very difficult. Joining us to talk about what's keeping the older cars on the road, aside from economic need, is Director of Insights at Edmunds, the online car shopping guide based here in Southern California, Ivan Drury. Ivan, thank you very much. Good to have you with us. I assume much of this is also driven by the fact that cars are much more reliable than they used to be.
Yeah, you know, that's actually one of a huge factor that people come to find out, fortunately, when they experience it in times that are in need. It's one of those things where, you know, there's a lot of preconceived notions about certain mileage milestones where a vehicle's durability will kind of fall off a cliff. You know, that old adage of 100,000 miles, the mythical 100,000 mile marker. But, you know, once you get past that and you've done at least the basic maintenance on this vehicle, which isn't usually a lot, we're talking about oil changes and, you know, belts, like just normal stuff, vehicles will go 150, 200,000 miles. It's not unheard of. So it's interesting that we've seen this happen in the past when the recession from the housing crisis came about. You know, unemployment went up, people had ruined credit, and they literally could not buy a car. And they too found out that, you know what? My car can keep going. I might have to shuffle some things around to kind of, you know, make ways to make a repair or two here or extend that maintenance schedule in some way, shape, or form. But I think a lot of people who were around for that, you know, last that recessionary period, they might have experienced something they didn't want to, but it was something very valuable. The vehicle durability is very good today.
And Ivan, it's got to be a great time to be in the car repair business, because with so many people just deciding they're going to fix what's wrong instead of get another car, that's got to put a lot of demand on shops. And I don't know if this is still the case, but I know for a time there was a real shortage of car technicians to work on the vehicles. Do you know what the employment levels are for that? And is there still high demand for people with that training?
You know, it's interesting you mentioned it, because I think a lot of the trades jobs, they still do not have the right amount of headcount, right? We don't have enough filled positions in many traditional occupations, and automotive is definitely one of them. It's one of these things where it hasn't become a so-called aspirational job yet. The pay is good. The working conditions are much better than many people would assume, and it's actually increasingly a high-tech job, because when you look at the electrification of a vehicle, a lot of these techs, it's not a guy, you know, working under the hood and there's grease spilling out and it's hot and it's oily. I mean, I worked at a gas station with the repair station on the side for years, and the conditions are greatly improved.
You know, it's I did that too for a summer.
Yeah, it's
came home covered in grease every day. It doesn't look the same when I take my car to the shop now. They're all clean.
Precisely. They look almost too clean. You wonder what happened. But it's like, well, they hooked up a diagnostic tool. They changed out a computer module. You know, these are very different repairs from back when there was carburation and guys were fiddling around little parts and hoping what they did was going to work. It's a lot more scientific and a little more straightforward today. Now, don't get me wrong, cars are extremely complicated, but the amount of people that we have that would sufficiently fill those voids, it's not there yet. It's one of those things where I think that people would find, though, it is an occupation that can be rather fulfilling.
Yeah,
but it's just not something that, you know, people are aspiring to at this time.
I think if people saw what the compensation is, I was looking for, you know, some of the pay that people get, it would become aspirational, because you know, as you say, it's a high paying job, and provides, you know, degrees of freedom that there a lot of jobs don't. We're talking
stability.
Edmunds Director of Insights, Ivan Drury. I'd like to hear from you as we talk about the average age of American cars on the road now, more than 12 and a half years old, average age. And, you know, for every new car, that means there's one 20 years old out there. I'd like to hear from you if you have a particularly hard-driven car, one that's really got a lot of miles on it. You know, I'm thinking, you know, 200,000 plus, you've driven it, you know, long distance. Ideally, we're talking 300,000 plus. I'd like to hear the story about what's led you to keep the car. 866-893-5722. If you have a car that's more than 25 years old, I'd also be interested in hearing what's led you to hold on to it. Classic cars, we understand. But a car that's not a classic and is 25 years old, you're still driving it. I want to know about that. 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can also email us your input at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and your first name. What's going on now with the new car market, Ian? Are cars a bit more available than they were a couple years ago at the height of the pandemic?
Yeah, if we look at today's availability and inventory just in general, things have increased. We're not nearly at that same trough that we were, you know, this time last year when people were buying cars sight unseen. They're outbidding one another. People are putting custom orders in for cars that are really just daily drivers, point A to point B vehicles, you know, Honda Civics and even like a Mercedes C-Class. You know, people wouldn't custom order these vehicles in a normal time. But things, they've gotten better, but we're not there yet. You know, for the consumer who's bought a car in their, you know, history, they've got, you know, 2-3 purchases under their belt. They're accustomed to low APR financing, thousands of dollars cash back, things like that. That's not there because we just don't have the inventory. And especially certain makes and models, you'll still find they're depleted. Dealers will not have any vehicles on the lot that fit the configuration that what somebody wants. So there's still custom orders being placed. There's still shortages. It's not as bad, but it's not as widespread either. It's just you have to do your homework now more so than ever, because, you know, to couple things together with this is the other half of the equation. When you purchase, if you have a trade-in, those values are in a state of fluctuation. Mm. You know, we saw some dipping earlier, definitely not at the height that they were last year. They've gone up a little bit recently. But the question is, you know, if you have it, is it worth trading it now? That's where universally a year ago, I would have said, trade in any car you got.
Yeah, just because the value of the used car is so strong. I kept getting mailings from the dealership that sold me my car several years ago. We'll buy it back. Please sell it to us. Anyway, we'll find you another car. It was pretty funny. I was getting them monthly. Ivan, the other, of course, is car interest rates, and that's pushed the monthly payment. And again, this is just average. So a lot of cars, you know, half of them are higher, over $720 a month in paying a car loan. That's, you know, most people can't afford to pay that.
No, it's a staggering sum of money. And like you say, that's literally just the average. We look at people who are paying over $1,000 a month. It's almost one in six of those car loans is $1,000 a month. Wow. And of course, there's more than that. There's $1,200, there's $1,500 a month notes. And it's kind of, it's a bizarre dynamic in the sense, if you look at that consumer base, and can they afford it? And people fall into one of two categories. You know, they're either taking out a very aggressive loan schedule payment of 36 or 48 months, but they're getting automaker backed, you know, 0.9, 0%, 1.9 financing, which, you know, even if you pay 1.9% APR, that's essentially free money in this environment.
It's like paying me to take
with
the loan.
Inflation so high.
Yeah.
Right. And the other end of the spectrum, though, unfortunately, you've got people who are taking out, you know, the 72, the 84 month loan, and they've got a vehicle that's, you know, $70,000, $80,000, $100,000, and the interest rate is much higher. It's like 9%, 12%. And the interest over the life of the loan can be something like, you know, 30K. And that's very different. And that bucket of people who are paying that $1,000, it's so different when you drill down to just that individual customer and why they're doing it. And some of it, they're financially sound. You know, people are putting down $15,000 on like a $40,000 car, they're paying it off in 3 years. You know, that's sound financial advice. Mm-hmm. But on the flip side, for the person who's barely scratching it together, they're just doing what they have to do in order to get, you know, XYZ vehicle that fits their lifestyle and their needs, that's where it gets extremely difficult to, you know, say like, hey, that's okay, but what else are you going to do? You got to get to work.
Exactly. John in Pomona says, I've had my car since 99, Subaru Forester. My daughter drove it for college. Now my son is driving it for high school. Yeah, it's always nice when you have family members who can inherit the vehicles and keep them going. We're talking with Edmunds' Ivan Drury. We'll continue with him. We have a number of listeners who've called. I really want to hear what Adam and Reed and Mike have to say about their cars that have been driven for many years, hundreds of thousands of miles on them. We're talking about how American cars on the road have gotten much older.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We're talking cars and how old they are. On the road right now, a record-setting length of tenure for drivers, 12 and a half years on average across the United States. That's on average for American cars. When you're talking sedans, it's even older, more than 13 and a half years, the average age of the American sedan that's on the road. We're talking with Ivan Drury, Director of Insights at the online car shopping guide Edmunds, which is based right here in Southern California. Let's take some calls, beginning with Reed in Pomona. Reed, good to have you with us. Share with us about your old car that you're still driving.
Good morning, Larry. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
I had a 1996 Ford Taurus that just 2 weeks ago I donated to the radio station.
Thank you.
I would mind. And it was a very easy process, but it was running up until that morning when they hauled it away. I bought it new in 96. It's driven all over the place, really all over. My son, who is 20, was born, I guess that'd be 2002. He grew up in that car and has been driving it for the last few years. That's been his first car. So it was an emotional donation.
I'll bet,
but,
yeah.
We got a lot of miles and a lot of fun out of that car.
Two generations. What's the approximate mileage when you gave it to us?
No idea. It quit at 150,000.
Oh, okay. It was so much the odometer said this is enough. Reed, yeah. I love it. And it was a reliable car for all 27 years of its life?
Yes, yeah, after the first couple of years when we had to replace the transmission.
Oh, no.
We had three of them in there before, and it was just a couple of years old, but it ran perfectly for the last 20 or so.
That's great. Reed,
fantastic car.
I appreciate it, and thank you for the donation. As I just mentioned, we've come up short on those because everybody's holding on to their cars, but thank you for that. We really appreciate 1996 Ford Taurus. That's Reed in Pomona. Let's talk next with Mike in Sherman Oaks. Good to have you with us. Mike, what old car are you driving?
Well, 2008 Mercury Mariner, the 405 as we speak, 315,129 miles.
And it's a 2008, and you put that many miles on it. I'm impressed.
Yeah, well, I drive a lot. I have a couple of Jags, so I save those for, you know, nights and weekends. But I drive this all the time because of all the mileage, yeah.
That's great. So your daily driver has 315,000 miles on it. And has the Mariner been reliable for you through all this?
Yeah, all I've ever done is oil changes, tires, brakes, a few light bulbs. By the way, I re-upped yesterday as a Leadership Circle member, so hopefully some people out there will do the same.
Hey, Mike, we are so excited to hear that. Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Mike in Sherman Oaks, Mercury Mariner, 315,000 miles on it and still going. Ivan, I'm impressed because he obviously drives as a big part of his job. That's the only way he'd rack up that kind of mileage in that period of time. And, you know, you think for people who are reliant on driving a lot that maybe they'd be, you know, looking at a new car. Maybe it's better, though, if you got something you know is reliable, why take the chance on something that's uncertain?
Yeah, that's kind of the go with what you know mentality,
yeah,
right? It's one of the major motivators for when people do buy a new car. They just go back to the same brand, right? You don't want to kind of risk it and roll the dice. Sometimes you do. It doesn't work out. You get burnt. You go back to your old brand. But no, you're right. It's interesting because I worked on quality studies for quite some time as well. And cars, when they break down, it's like the Taurus owner said, that they might break down in the beginning of the lifestyle cycle when the car's kind of new and things are being vetted out. And the other kind of transitionary period is near the end of the vehicle's life. But that interim period, that sweet spot of, you know, that 100+ thousand miles of carefree driving, of basic maintenance, that's something that hopefully for today's owners who are holding on, they can look forward to. You know, instead of fearing, hey, when's that major breakdown going to happen? It's like, realize if you've done the basics, the odds are very low that your vehicle will just keep on going. And, you know, those mileage markers that consumers start to hit, you know, I think it starts to get ingrained in their head of, why would I ever?
Yeah.
So you end up with some people who, they learn this lesson and they take it to heart and they do drive it till the wheels fall off.
Oliver in Highland Park, what are you driving and how many miles do you have on it?
Hello. I have a GMC Jimny 1994. It was bought when I was in high school by my parents, when I was a junior, and then given to me. And so it's been a car that I've driven up until about a year ago. And it has 320,000 miles on it. It's still driving, but it didn't pass mod, and so we're not sure what to do. And so we actually may be like Reed looking to donate it to LA Rescue.
Thank you. Oh, that's great, Oliver. I appreciate it. That's wonderful. Yeah, and we have in the past gotten a fair number of vehicles for just the reason you mentioned that they couldn't be smogged. So that's one of the ways we get the cars donated to us for that very reason. 1994 GMC Jimmy, 320,000 miles on it. And Oliver, until it couldn't pass smog, it sounds like it was a reliable vehicle for you.
Yep, never had to do an engine replacement or transmissions. So
nearly made 30 years. All right. Oliver, thank you so much. Patricia in Topanga said, I've had my car since 1967. I'm driving it right now, a Toyota MR2. Incredibly fun car to drive. I have people leave notes on my windshield all the time, sharing how much they love the car and asking if I'll sell it. I bet they do, Patricia. A 1967 MR2. She didn't tell us what the mileage was. Ivan, some of these old cars that, you know, people are really looking for. I'm sure people get purchase proposals all the time.
Yeah, a lot of vehicles like that. You end up with the notes on your car. I've had a few vehicles where you get a lot of thumbs ups and a lot of people come to ask you, hey, you looking to sell that? Or what's the mileage like? And it's kind of this good thing, especially in California, right? There's so much nostalgia around autos that you end up with people that you would never think are auto enthusiasts in one way, shape, or form coming up to you and just talking story, chatting about that vehicle with you. And it's interesting because when I worked at that repair shop, you would even see it there because it basically looked like a used car lot to some people. They would come by and just wonder, hey, what's that being repaired for? Maybe I can buy it off the owner over there. What's going on? So it's definitely, the more miles you pawn, the more interesting stories you get out of it.
Well, it's funny. The last car I sold private party was a Maxima. And it was a guy actually worked at the Nissan dealership who bought it off of me. So it was a great car, by the way. But just it was at that point, would need a lot of money put into it. Rick in Westminster says, I have a 20-year-old Tahoe. Very, very reliable car. Megan, did you have a story that you were going to share? About, I thought you were maybe indicating something.
I do. The notes on my car are that they buy junk cars because I have like a 15-year-old Honda Fit that I was using, 16-year-old's car. But yeah, and a number of my friends have given their cars to SCPR, to LAist, and they said the process has been great and really smooth. And I mean, I understand why people hold on to cars. I'm from a long family of holding on to cars until they fall apart. Yeah. My dad drove a car where he had to use a screwdriver to get in on the passenger side, and the odometer stopped working. And then at some point, the speedometer stopped working. But he loved it. It was like a blue Dodge station wagon. Yeah. So there you go.
I had a friend whose passenger door didn't work on his car. And he was taking a woman out and he was telling how, you know, you have to get on my side and scoot over. She said, no. And she climbed through the window in the car. He fell in love and they got married. Ivan, before we let you go, I just wanted to thank you for joining us. And it doesn't look like this trend is going to change anytime soon, does it?
You know, I mean, with the economy doing what it is and some people kind of hedging their bets and holding off, I think that we're going to see kind of this interesting dynamic of holdouts versus people who have just been waiting and they've been itching to buy over, you know, the last 2 years. So it's one of those things where we start to see people, they want that new car, or their friend got something new, there's some new features they really like. So it's in the cards right now that it could go one way or the other.
Ivan Drury, thank you so much. From Edmunds, Director of Insights at the Online Car Shopping Guide. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Larry Mantle with Los Angeles City Council member Eunices Hernandez joining us to talk about a motion proposing a feasibility study for Los Angeles apartments to look at the cost of air conditioning being installed in them. Council member, thank you very much for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Larry.
So Los Angeles Times investigation a couple of years ago showed nearly 4,000 deaths caused by extreme heat throughout California over the previous decade. I'm just curious about what we know about deaths due to heat-related events being caused from people who are housed versus those living on the street or working outdoors. Do we have good numbers to really quantify in terms of health issues, the need for air conditioning indoors?
We don't have all the data yet. It's something I have to get back to you on. But what we know is that a lot of our seniors and a lot of our people who have disabilities are experiencing, you know, some of our hottest summers. And, you know, we represent CD1, which encompasses MacArthur Park, Pico Union, Westlake, which are some of the neighborhoods that are up to three times denser than any other part of Los Angeles. And that's because we have a lot of apartment buildings there. And so we'll get back to you on the data, but we know from knocking doors, from talking with our community, that this is an issue that particularly impacts our seniors and people with disabilities.
I was also wondering about units that are substandard we have in Los Angeles, and I don't know how much in your district, but garage conversions, uninsulated places, shack-like structures where you may have a large number of family members who are living there. And I would think that places like that that aren't really controlled by legal standards to begin with would be some of the highest areas of risk for overheating. And I wonder, is there any role that the city can have in those kinds of unregulated housing situations?
The role that our office is trying to play in those situations is that we have a CAT team, which is a community advocacy team in our office that goes out into the community and goes and knocks on doors, particularly in some of our neighborhoods that have some of these types of buildings and dwellings, so that they can connect with the tenants there to check habitability standards. So we do this for those type of units. We do these for apartment buildings in our district. And this is so we can make sure that things are habitable for people. And if they're not, then we bring the appropriate agencies, the appropriate departments, and the appropriate analysis so that we can get some of these things covered so that we can raise habitability standards, including, you know, access to ventilation and air. So we don't have a list, but our team is engaging some of these areas to get that information and to make sure folks are okay.
Council member, what are some of the things that you would like a feasibility study to look at if your proposal passes the council?
A couple of things. One is to look at the cost, to do an analysis on what the potential cost would be, to figure out how we can subsidize or how we can support the cost onto tenants, onto building owners. You know, we don't want this particular process to be an issue for either or. We just know that, you know, each year the summer is the hottest on record that we've seen each year. And so we just want to make sure we can implement this without it being a heavy cost on folks. Also, we're looking forward to the analysis on the grid. You know, people have concerns about the power grid if we, you know, start putting ACs into apartment buildings. But what I can tell you already is that our grid is fragile on many levels. We saw that during the storms earlier this year, thousands upon thousands of Angelenos lost power. And so we see this as an opportunity to really begin to address the weakness in our power grid. We have to, you know, meet head on the reality of climate change and that it's here and that we need to invest in building up our grid so that we can live up to the public health demands and public health standards that our communities ask us for. And if we don't do this, you know, we're putting the burden of a lack of infrastructure in our low-income community. So for me, those are the two most important pieces, is the cost and that, you know, we can upgrade our grid to handle this.
We're talking with Los Angeles City Council member Eunices Hernandez, joining us to talk about her proposal, which has passed its initial vote by the Los Angeles City Council to prepare a feasibility study on requiring air conditioning in all Los Angeles City rented units. And it sounds like what you're saying, council member, is in terms of who would bear the cost, this would be part of the study. This wouldn't necessarily be on property owners to where they couldn't recoup the cost of it through rent.
Exactly. This, we don't want it to be a burden. We want to figure out how we can make it as accessible as possible for everybody without, you know, it being a burden to people.
All right. And is there anything to be learned from hotter areas of California when you look, say, at the Inland Empire or the San Gabriel Valley, places with higher average temperatures than your district does? Are there any mandates there? Is it market forces, you know, push most places to have air conditioning or people won't rent those units? What do you see in those other areas from which you could do a comp as your district heats up?
So we're checking out, you know, the different policies, responses that local jurisdictions have around us, including those areas you mentioned. But what we know is that some of these areas have newer construction, and in newer construction, there's AC that's already incorporated. There's HVAC that's incorporated. And in the San Gabriel Valley, a lot of the locations are homes. And so homes have HVAC, or, you know, they have more access to AC in these areas, and they're a little bit higher income than some of the areas that we're really trying to prioritize in CD1 and throughout the city. And so we're always willing to learn, especially because, like you mentioned, other jurisdictions are ahead of the game on this. So we're going to take some of their lead. But I know that, you know, Councilmember Rahman has taken steps into making sure that any new building does have access to HVAC, has that they are electrical. So we're moving in the right direction. It's not happening fast enough, but we see it in line of sight.
With many of the older buildings that are in your district that I'm familiar with, there likely isn't the duct work that would handle central air conditioning, although I suppose the buildings could be retrofitted. That might be burdensome to the tenants. But there are, of course, window air conditioners in cases like that. You know, you've got it. It's not a consistent ability to cool the unit. But is that something that you would be looking at, window versus central air conditioning? And also, you know, temperatures that those units would have to reach, because there's air conditioning and then there's, you know, what purports to be air conditioning but doesn't have the power to cool the space where it's being applied. So how might that factor into this?
Yeah, so I think it's twofold. You know, one part of it is providing the education for our committee members about, you know, what their rights are around this once we move forward. And then the second piece is education for landlords about what the code has been changed to, and educating our landlords and our tenants about the programs that are run through, for example, the Department of Water and Power today, where you can get a rebate if you want to buy an AC through the LADWP website. So there are ways right now when our community members can get some of these resources, like a window AC or an AC for their apartment. We just want to expand that to have it to be a standard of habitability. But, you know, we already see that, you know, some of these practices are already being employed by some of our departments, and it's having tremendous success, especially for our low income community members who can't afford to buy an AC for their apartment.
Now, I know, Councilmember, you said you didn't want this to be burdensome, but it could be extremely costly to do this for buildings. And some of these units are going to be rent controlled because they're older structures. So would you see there be any loosening of rent control to potentially recoup the costs for property owners?
That is not our goal. We strongly believe in rent control, and our motion doesn't ask that the landlord put in, you know, vents or an HVAC system. In fact, we amended it so that it would be more clear that we're talking about AC appliances or units for within the apartment. So we don't expect there to be, you know, a high cost for this, and that's why we're doing the feasibility analysis on the cost, so we all can right. make sure wherever there is a cost, we can step up and support that.
So you'll be taking public input on this. Is that the next step?
Yes.
All right, Councilmember, thank you very much for joining us and talking about this proposal, the feasibility study, which appears likely to be undertaken. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much, Larry. Appreciate you. Have a great day.
Thanks so much. Joining us from the first Los Angeles City Council District, Councilmember Eunices Hernandez, joining us on Air Talk.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of the How to LA podcast. How about we go to the movies? Join us for a 10-part series, Revival House, and discover the magic of LA's indie theaters. Who knows? You might meet someone.
I know it sounds antithetical because you're just sitting passively, but in fact, you're connecting with everyone else around you.
Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
We were just talking with Los Angeles City Council member Eunices Hernandez about her proposal that a study be undertaken by the city to see if air conditioning could be required in the city's apartment rental stock. And now we're joined by the chief heat officer for the city of Los Angeles, Martha Segura. She's director of the Climate Emergency Mobilization Office. That's an LA city team that researches and implements climate-related solutions within Los Angeles. Martha, thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for inviting me, Larry.
So share with us right now, what are your top priorities? What's the most important thing you're working on, particularly with our upcoming warmer temperatures later this year?
That's right. So, Larry, as you probably know, last week we launched our Heat Relief for LA campaign, and that's part of a much larger early warning system. But what's important about the campaign is it involves right now over 70 organizations, nonprofits, and businesses to relay information to the larger Los Angeles community that heat season is no longer what it used to be. It's much hotter. Heat waves are more frequent, more intense, have a longer duration, which means our bodies have a longer time to recover and need much more planning ahead. So our heat relief campaign is our community or social infrastructure that we're working on. The other thing that we're working on with the city, and it's more of a long-term, is our public infrastructure. So those are the roads that you and I use, the tree canopies we use for shade in our neighborhoods, in our schools and communities, open and permeable surfaces, with the understanding that there has been historical disinvestment in the past. So there are areas of Los Angeles that obviously suffer more than others from heat-related injury, illness, and also excessive emergency room visits and deaths. So we want to make sure that the city of LA focuses in on those areas of high risk, and these shared public infrastructure projects are invested in those areas specifically. The other area that we want to focus on are these nature-based solutions, like not just urban forests and tree canopy, but obviously ensuring that we have more vegetation, more medians with greenery, because we found that the communities in Los Angeles and across the nation that have vegetation, that have tree canopy, have much better health outcomes. So that's part of our nature-based infrastructure.
Yo, there's been a lot. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. Please finish your point.
Yeah, well, the two other quick areas really are the built environment, which is what you were talking about with council member Eunices Hernandez, and the decarbonization and electrification of buildings, but also our social infrastructure, which I mentioned earlier. Go right ahead.
No, I was going to ask also about some of the things that are being experimented, I know, elsewhere. For example, reflective roofs on buildings, reflective material for covering roadways, all of these things to sort of reduce the heat that is held in the ground and keeps temperatures up at night, you know, after the sun even goes down. Are there any experiments being done with some of those materials in Los Angeles?
Absolutely. We've been piloting cool streets and cool pavements for a few years now. We also have the tried and true cool roofs, and we are investing in those, and we're also giving rebates for some of those projects to the Department of Water and Power if you're a business. And we have found that particularly with the cool pavement, it has to be a multifaceted approach. It's not just the pavement, but you do have to have tree canopy. You do have to ensure that there are other materials in place to reflect the radiant heat during the daytime. Because unfortunately, during the daytime, it radiates the heat out of the street. And we want to make sure that doesn't impact the pedestrians that are walking by. So we want to make sure that when we apply cool pavement in the future, that it's accompanied by these other solutions.
We're talking with the chief heat officer for the city of Los Angeles, Marta Segura, who directs the Climate Emergency Mobilization Office for the city of Los Angeles. Marta, one of the questions I asked the council member was about, you know, many of these unregulated places where people live, often in very dense living circumstances. I'm talking about converted garages, buildings that, you know, back part of office, places where maybe the insulation isn't great, there's not air conditioning. Is there anything your office can do in those cases where people are living in substandard, very hot circumstances?
Well, my office is part of this broader communications campaign, is training various departments like the Housing Authority, LAHD, Department of Neighborhood Empowerment, Public Works, et cetera. And we're providing them with information on how to prevent these types of injuries within the context of their work in their departments. But we want to make sure that the departments that are responsible, for example, housing or building and safety, are the ones that are sharing this information, implementing this information. And then it also goes back to the building decarbonization policies that the city of Los Angeles has one of them we passed, which is the new building decarbonization policy. And then the other one we're contemplating, which is the existing building decarbonization. And I think those two policies are key to have a more systemic, broad-based approach for what Councilmember Eunices Hernandez is proposing, but also to ensure that we are addressing the health and safety of all tenants. The ones that live in garages, for example, the ones that live at multiple families per unit. Those are multifaceted approach by various departments that just really need to get out there and ensure that we're providing these healthy amenities for all of them.
As we're seeing Los Angeles get hotter, and really the whole American West under the same circumstance, what are you able to learn from areas that are, you know, that have in recent decades been the temperature that Los Angeles is going to get to? I'm talking about the Inland Empire, areas, some of the desert locations. What do you learn from their practices in dealing with heat that's applicable here as Los Angeles gets hotter?
Yeah, I think that we're learning that, and even from our own lessons, right, that instead of just having a policy to plant more trees, we want to plant more trees where they're most needed. Instead of just having an overall policy to reduce emissions everywhere, we should have targeted areas where we reduce emissions more so than others. Because I think if we accelerate those investments in the areas that are at highest risk and greatest emissions and the least tree canopy and most historically disinvested, we will see accelerated solutions and accelerated results. We will have most improvements in reducing deaths and hospitalizations, and we'll be able to track them because now we have this UCLA heat risk map, right, that demonstrates what the excess deaths and hospitalizations are in these areas of highest risk. So if we collaborate with the Department of Public Health and LA County Department of Public Health, we can just like we did with the pandemic, we can potentially track the reduced impacts from extreme heat during the summer.
Well, and having health tracking would seem important. It's my understanding that, for example, people with type 2 diabetes are even more susceptible to complications with the heat, for example. So areas where there are high rates of diabetes, I think, would be of particular concern. Marta Segura, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it so much.
I agree, Larry. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful rest of your afternoon.
You too. Chief Heat Officer for the City of Los Angeles. She directs the Climate Emergency Mobilization Office. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Always a pleasure for me to talk with members of our backbone here at LAist 89.3. These are the folks who do such important work that we wouldn't exist without them. And they're every bit as dedicated as anyone that you hear on the air. I know that because I see so many of them do their work. This is not a punch the clock kind of a company. And these are people that care very much about what the experience is like for listening to LAist 89.3. I'm joined by Jason Georges, Project Coordinator on LAist Digital Product Team. Jason, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Larry.
So you've been with us 16 years, is that right?
Yes, I've been here before we moved into our building.
And the other member of our backbone team is the opposite. She's been here a year, and we'll hear from her in a moment. But Jason, share with us, first of all, what does it get you up in the morning coming to the job? What is it that you really like about what you do?
I love working here. I've been here a long time, and every day, every week, every year is something different, something new. It's a great experience. It encourages me to live my life and to be around new people, a diverse staff. I learn all kinds of things that I've never learned before every day. And what I do is basically publish the news online, and that keeps me informed more than anything else.
Yeah, so you are immersed in this every day, and you're someone who has a lot in your skill set. And so what are the different skills that you bring to your job to publish the news every day?
Well, I have a slightly technical background, and I have a human development background. I got my degree in human development from Long Beach State, and I have been doing the web since the beginning of the web. And so...
And our websites, which have evolved over the years.
Several different generations.
Yeah, what generation are we on now?
We're on like the sixth generation of the KPCC site, or the LAS site.
Yeah. So, and being here 16 years, how does being here for all that time come into play? The institutional knowledge, the experience.
So it allows me to see patterns that have developed over time. Mistakes that have been made in the past. I can think about what did we do in the past that was leading to a mistake? And I can bring it up in the current time and say, hey, we've done this before. We might want to do it a different way. Or if there were things we did in the past, like publishing news in a different way that we stopped doing, we're now going to have a chance to bring that back and try a new way. So I'm looking forward to some of the changes that are coming in the near future.
Yeah, you're giving us a little preview of what's to come.
Yeah, there's a lot that's going to be changing in the next couple of years with the websites and especially with the apps. So we're really looking forward to the future here.
Well, something, of course, for the audio side of it, we see is an ever higher percentage of listeners to LAist 89.3 access us through the app, mm-hmm. and so they can take us wherever they go. It's just much more convenient.
There's a plethora of different products, different ways people listen and interact with LAist and with our news.
So true. Well, also joining us from the backbone is Sarah Steinman, membership manager for LAist. I mentioned she's been with us for about a year. You were at Kidspace Museum, the Children's Museum here in Pasadena before.
Yeah, so not too far away. Also working in membership over there, but very different kind of membership than what we've got here, where all the members are supporting everything we do here. Yeah.
Well, it seems like it'd be a great place. We're such a beautiful location in the Arroyo where Kidspace is. There, it's about people, I guess, who'd be purchasing membership to the museum. So how is it different what you're doing here with LAist membership?
Yeah. So here, everyone who donates is a member of LAist. And so that kind of becomes a big community that's supporting everything we do here, which we know we've been kind of hearing a lot about that the last couple of days. But yeah, so definitely a member supported news is super important because that just means that we're here to kind of give back to the the members that support us, rather than kind of answering to anyone else.
So you're responsible for direct mail and telemarketing to build membership as well. And why is that necessary as part of the fundraising effort of LAist?
Yeah, so the direct mail and telefundraising, kind of all different parts, we call it like a multi-channel approach. So somebody might be listening to the drive and see that we've got a piece of mail that we got from LAist as well. And that might kind of be the thing that reminds them to either send the piece of mail in or give us a call or go online to donate. So and I think also just people have so many different ways that they prefer to donate and give back. So that just gives people the opportunity to kind of donate in a way that they feel comfortable with.
So are you the one who sees the comments that contributors make when they make a donation? They can leave a comment. Are you the one who sees those?
Sometimes. I would definitely say I see a lot more of those during the pledge drive. So that's one cool thing about working on the pledge drive. The spring drive was the first one that I worked on. Definitely seeing a lot of those during the drives. But we also have a really awesome member audience services team, and they're the people who answer all the phones and emails. So they're the ones who really see kind of everything that's coming in from our members. They talk to them every single day. So
you started in the first drive, you said, was the spring drive, this one that we had just a few months ago.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was a remarkable one, because like this one, we started really slowly, mm-hmm. and then things really turned. We got super honest with the audience about what the stakes were and what it meant with how far behind we were, because mm-hmm. we were looking at a devastating financial result if it would have kept up at that pace.
Yeah.
And so what were your thoughts about seeing our member drive really pivot in the messaging to really let listeners know the stakes involved?
Yeah, I could honestly say I had never seen anything like it before. The beginning of that second week felt we weren't sure what was going to happen, but definitely just seeing the numbers grow and all of our supporters kind of step up and help us make that goal was pretty amazing. And it's definitely a big contrast from the direct mail and the telefundraising, just because the results from those kind of come in a little bit more slowly. So to be in the room kind of with everyone on air, seeing how the messaging really made a very quick change was pretty incredible. And yeah, just seeing how the whole membership team made a change to kind of help things pick up.
We're talking with membership manager for LAist, Sarah Steinman, with us. We need to wrap soon, but I wanted to ask each of you, and Jason, I'll start with you, Jason Georges, who is our LAist digital product team project coordinator. How do you think this job, just briefly, has affected your life doing this kind of work?
Well, I've been able to raise a family while doing this job. I live close to work. The pandemic is actually great because it allowed me to be with my family and as they transitioned from high school into college and spend those, you know, the final few years with my kids before they went away.
Yeah.
I think I've become a better person. I've become a much more informed person. It's almost like I'm a listener to the radio station. I'm listening to you every day, but more intimately because I'm here.
Because you're part of it. Because you're part of it.
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier kind of, you know, the diversity of the team. Everybody who's on the Air Talk team is much younger than I am. Their parents are younger than mm-hmm. me. And I learn so much by being with this group of smart, engaged, deeply caring people much younger than me. I have so much respect for them. And I just think it's hard for me to express how much effect working with people like that have had on me. Sarah, I know you've only been here a year, but has your life changed much in the year because of working here? Just briefly.
Yeah, I think it's really great to help others connect to living in LA, because I remember living here for a long time when I didn't feel as connected to it. So yeah. I think that's a really great thing to help people find that awesome restaurant in their neighborhood.
Yeah. Happening.
Yeah.
That's right. You're the center of stuff. Sarah, Jason, thank you both.
You are part of
the backbone, and we appreciate what you do very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.